The Dead Zone Containment Protocols from Mantic Games.
The Hunt by Michael Gray.
Are we ready, Captain?
We are, ma'am. Recon Unit 5235 has been briefed and understands that he must give full disclosure.
Very good. Unit 5235, you have been summoned to this council to give a full and truthful account of your actions during the Nexus Psi Containment Protocol. The result of this testimony will determine your future operational status. Do you understand these terms as they have been read to you?
Yes, ma'am.
Unit 5235, tell us your mission purpose during the incident.
I was assigned to Task Force Epsilon. The mission was to drop onto the north coast of the continent designated C4. As the least populated major landmass, C4 has avoided much of the effects of the outbreak. Epsilon was triggered when the recon unit on C2 lost track of a group of second-generation infected. The target vector suggested we could have reached C4. The mission objectives were to locate and tag the second gens for termination when larger forces can be released from the contact zones.
How many were you in the task force?
One, ma'am. I was Task Force Epsilon.
The sun was strong this close to Nexus-Psi's equator. It stroked Five's bare shoulders with appreciable weight, and the sweet, heavy air covered him like a blanket. Even with his cultured physiology, he had to shake his head to lose a sweat gathering in his eyebrows. He was near the northern tip of C4, atop an outcrop of basalt, which gave him an uninterrupted view of the forest below. If he climbed to the ridge's tip and looked north, he would see the stretch of turquoise water between this continent and C2, and the islets and atolls leapfrogging between. From the ridge's height, the ground dropped quickly, revealing a livid green quilt of treetops stretching as far as humidity would allow, broken only here and there with upthrusts of black rock fingers. Somewhere a bird called a hacking laugh. Another took flight in a riot of violently colored feathers. The forest floor shifted with teeming life, insect, mammalian, and reptile. And every tree housed in an ever-shifting ecosystem of movement. Among this whole continent, Five was expected to find his target, a challenge worthy of his training. If the second gens were on C4, they would have to come this way, and he would find them. His drone cloud beeped for attention. Five blinked to call up their information. In the 4 hours since dispersal, the drones had swept 459,951 square kilometers. No indication of the second gens had yet been found. But that only represented 6% of C4's landmass. The timing was within mission parameters. An icon winked in his vision, one he had not seen outside of training. He blinked, bringing it to the fore. One of the drones had gone offline. Not an uncommon event, but worth attention. He called up its last broadcast position, vectored against his map of C4, and then began running. He jumped moldering roots and vaulted fallen branches, calling up a cloud diagnostic run with another blink as he did so. The report showed no failures on the drone's part, only that it had stopped responding when it entered
Haven.
The only major settlement on C4. The original designation was S0001. Haven was the local term.
I see. What caused the drone to go offline?
We don't know. The diagnostic showed no software or hardware failures. It's assumed it was offline by either active or passive defenses around the settlement's perimeter.
And by that you mean?
It was identified and purposefully destroyed, or it wandered into an area protected by surveillance countermeasures. These measures can destroy a drone physically or short internal electronics.
And which was it?
We don't know.
Violence had visited Haven's outer wards. That much was obvious. Bullets, telltale tracks across walls. Prefab buildings had their corners blown inwards by what looked like anti-personnel explosions. The buildings and streets were deserted. All-terrain vehicles had been abandoned on thoroughfares in what could have been makeshift barricades. He looked over at one as he passed, a two-seater ATV. The driver's personal touches were still there. Oiled leather wraps padded out the seat cushioning. The paw of some small mammal dangling like a totem from the roll bar. And more tellingly, the ignition stick still in the controls. He was clear of the tree line when a flyer rose above the buildings ahead of him. He ran for cover with a sprint which tore up topsoil, a move prompted by instinct rather than knowledge that containment protocols would have ground all aircraft on the planet. Safely behind a prefab wall, he looked out. The flyer was not military. but neither was it wholly civilian. Closer now, he could see the small arms spot welded to the hull. It rose above the squat buildings of Haven and began to move, slowly at first, but accelerating quickly, as its nose tilted towards the atmosphere, its engine shrieking as it gained speed. As Five watched, another similarly adapted flyer descended from the sky, slowing as it approached to land somewhere unseen within the settlement. There had been nothing in the brief about civilian evacuation. The situation dictated caution, so Five called in his drone cloud. He was only partially surprised when, one by one, the drones blinked out of his awareness as they neared Haven. He would have to investigate personally. Five kept off the streets, making his way inwards, using the empty buildings, through deserted habitation blocks and makeshift administration centers. Signs of sudden abandonment were everywhere, from filing drawers left yawning empty to plastic mugs left near to open windows. The old coffee inside mixed tan with murky rainwater. He stalked through a deserted classroom, the only sound of broken plexiglass crunching beneath his boots. Falling leaves lay in a drift across the floor, blown through shattered windows to soak the stick figure drawings littering the floor. He was almost ready to believe this place was completely dead, and then he looked outside and saw the barricade. Cargo containers had been positioned, and explosives looked to have been used on the surrounding buildings to plug the gaps. Neocrete blocks had been pushed along its tops like parapets, behind which Five could see two figures patrolling. He did not need to zoom in to know they were armed. He watched them through the ruined wall of a building, long enough to confirm the pattern of their movement. They were never alone, yet far enough apart to cover all approaches. These were not colonist miners. They were patrolling in military fashion. Someone beyond that wall knew what they were doing. That he could get behind the barricade was not in question, but he first needed to know if it was necessary. His mission objective remained, and he doubted the sentries would be as calm as they looked if any stage twos were nearby. More information would be needed before he proceeded. He pushed himself away from the hole. He would scout further along the barricade for clues as to what was happening in Haven. Approaching the door, he stopped, stepped to one side, and pressed himself against the wall. He shook loose the knife strapped to his arm with a tricep flex and caught it before it could hit the floor. He stood there rigid for more than 2 minutes. His heart rate slowed, chest barely rising with breath. Only the distant whine of flyer motors taking off intruded on the stillness. Then a noise, a stone sliding down rubble, low-pitched chatter, spattered with oddly inflected words. A figure walked through the door, short compared to Five, with tawny brown fur. It moved lightly on deceptively thin legs with reversed knees. Five knew what the creature was and felt fortunate it checked the opposite way when it came through the door. His knife lashed out, aimed precisely for the creature's jugular. It would have struck had his target not had a friend behind. It called out in a chittering voice, making the first creature duck. Five's target simultaneously dropped and threw its head away from the blade. Instead of slicing open its throat, Five's knife pierced the skin and slid up its cheek. The grind of bone on metal shook the knife in his hand. The creature yelped in pain, but continued its roll, taking it from his reach and opening Five for a counterattack from its companion. It came in a rush, much quicker than a normal human ever could. But however quick it was, Five was faster. His knife was outstretched for the blow intended for the first creature. Five flicked it into an uphand grip and paused a fraction of a second. The creature's attack was instinctual, born of a desire to protect its friend. When Five didn't retreat under its rush, its eyebrows raised as it realized its mistake. Five took one step forward and brought the knife around, letting the creature's attack bring it the rest of the way. With a push, Five drove the blade through its throat. It slid through gristle and windpipe without noticeable friction. The spine was a faint tremor on the handle, and the blade emerged wiped clean from the back of its neck. The creature's eyes remained wide as it tried to cough, managing only a dry hack as it convulsed. Five looked around, ready to protect himself from the other creature. The room was empty. He looked about quickly. Two possible exits, another door, and the hole through the shattered wall that led into the street. He made a swift calculation. The creatures were caught unaware, comfortable in their environment. That suggested they saw Haven as their territory, that they came from behind the barricade. Therefore, that was where they would run. So then, the street. He pulled his knife free, and was halfway up the rubble when a splash of color in the room's dark gray caught his eye. A drop of blood by the second door. Five changed direction, and was through the door before the dead creature hit the ground. He ducked a fallen beam, followed paw prints in the thick dust to another room. The walls and floor blurred by as he focused on signs of his quarry. Through another corridor into what was once an entrance hall, at its end a doorway swung from recent passage. He broke through it at a run, and was washed in yellow afternoon light. After hours in shadow, his eyes fought to compensate for the light saturating his pupils. He blinked, brought the street into focus, and saw the creature across the road. It was fast, perhaps as fast as him. Then Five saw where it was running. At the street's end was one section of the barricade surrounding Haven's center. From here, he could see two sentries on its top, and the creature was running directly for them. Five reached down and picked up a rock, hefted its weight, judged the distance, and let fly. The creature continued running, putting more distance between it and Five. 20 meters. 23. 25. As it reached 26 meters, it went suddenly rigid as the rock found its mark, and crumpled to the ground with a soft thud. The sentries on the wall had not even looked in their direction.
What were they?
Yindage.
I've heard that word.
Pre-industrial subrace, sir. They came from a planet called Azur-9, which was optimized by House Bosestau. When Bosestau contact vessel landed, they found the planet inhabited and claimed the race as an exploitable asset under the right of option.
Then what were they doing on Nexus Psi?
Some escaped and joined the rebellion.
Is that what they were doing in Haven?
Affirmative.
If you established rebel activity in Haven, why didn't you assault the settlement?
Operational necessity. I did not know at the time if that would be required, and judged the risk of detection too great.
You must have known who the craft belonged to by then, though. The rebellion poses a clear and present threat to all sphere operations.
I was almost certain. However, intercession and potential rebellion activities was outside my mission parameters at the time.
At the time?
That's correct.
Five dragged the body from the street. The back of its head was severely dented, and yellow fluid soaked its body hair. It left a slick trail across the ground, but the sun was setting, and this close to the equator, there was little twilight to speak of. By the time the blood slick was seen, Five would already be clicks away. He patted the body down, tossing aside knives and pistols, too small for his own hands, until he found what he was looking for, a radio, a primitive thing, old but well cared for. It was simple, easily repaired in the field, and just as easily hacked by someone who knew what they were doing. Within a minute, he had the handset open and security bypassed. The set hissed with empty static. There was a burst as someone spoke a name and arrival time. An answer, just a short, cut through the hiss, and then nothing. Five found a defensible room and listened while night settled on Nexus Psi. Intercepted messages came through in half-decipherable bursts, mixtures of plain language and code words, unfathomable on their own. Five monitored and absorbed as the night air filled with constant schedule of takeoffs, and the planet rotated until its sun once more broke the eastern horizons, until the weight of the codes built up a mass to be cross-referenceable. The rebellion were on Nexus Psi, and they were evacuating Haven civilians. The radio transmissions left much unsaid, but connecting the disparate pieces of communication was simple enough. A rebel cruiser, or perhaps more than one, had taken advantage of the containment protocol to resupply. Five almost admired the nerve, choosing the least active continent, they had placed themselves at anchor directly over the South Pole, the magnetic fields disrupting readings from the Enforcer fleet encircling most of the planet. And even beyond that, a dead zone was never a place to enter lightly. However, the operational precedent was clear. All rebellion activity was to be immediately reported to command, regardless of current mission status. Five switched off the radio. However much nerve these people had, they had just overstepped the line. He blink-clicked his own comms and sent a data packet with his findings flagged critical. The file sent and was almost immediately returned, marked sent failure. He tried again with the same result. He risked vocal communications and tried to hail command. Nothing, not even static. He powered down the comms with another blink and sat in the silence, thinking. Whoever sat behind those barricades was capable of neutralizing a drone cloud. The cessation of static comms was not a great leap. The last solid contact with command had been at insertion. While it was possible the quiet zone did not stretch the entire way to C-Force North, he could not be sure. It would take him perhaps a day to reach that position, assuming the quiet zone had not expanded. He checked his inventory while he considered his options. He could return north and try to reach command, or infiltrate Haven, neutralize the comms blackout, and make contact afterwards. Neither was optimal. Both were shot through with uncertainties, and the latter could leave him dead and unable to complete his mission. Or perhaps there was another option.
What were the rebels doing in the settlement?
They approached the citizens of Haven after the containment protocol had been declared, offering evacuation in exchange for supplies. It appeared that the consensus in the settlement was not to accept.
Thus explaining the signs of conflict you had seen?
Affirmative. It appears the colonists' defenders changed their minds after they were quickly overrun.
When Rebel presence was verified, why did you not engage the forces within Haven?
Operational uncertainties. The internal layout of the settlement. Possible defenses and personnel were not known. I assessed the potential success to risk ratio was not optimal.
Had you been captured, you would have been executed, is that correct?
Eventually. Although the rebellion had been known to torture Sphere military personnel first. However, recon units are provided specific measures to ensure capture is not a possibility.
Are you certain fear for your personal safety did not color your judgment?
I am. I am aware of my status as one of the assets among thousands. Tactical considerations were based solely on likely mission outcome.
Then specify, why did you not assault Haven?
Asset to target ratios. There could be anything up to several hundred enemy soldiers behind that barricade. I did not have that many bullets.
It would stand to reason, recon unit, that they would be armed with their own. And explosive charges you've already noted the effects of. Why did you not pursue that course?
I did. Just to a much larger degree.
When containment protocols shut down the Navicom and scrambled geosynchronous locators, the cargo ship Zanzibar had been unlucky enough to find itself in motion above the planet. Shifting anchor in the upper atmosphere, blind and with no bearings, the Megahauler collided with the smaller Nightjar-class Gemini, dislodging both from stable orbit into Nexus-sized gravity well. Zanzibar was nothing more than a motorized warehouse, designed and built to shift bulk goods across the vast emptiness of space. But the Gemini stood out in the mission briefing, as out of place a Nexus-I as the infected. Anomalies in mission prep always stuck in Five's mind. It was often the apparently insignificant details which were the difference between mission failure and success, and that was why Five was on C4's western coast, wading into the warm surf. The Gemini's entrance into the planet's atmosphere had been low. Last gasp safety measures and correctional thrusters had deployed, attempting a landing on C4's unfriendly topography. The ship had carved a trough through the forest 50 meters wide and beginning 10 kilometers inland, leading all the way to the ocean. Trees bent seaward on the trench's edge in sympathy with Gemini's final landing, blackened where engines had attempted to burn off remaining fuel before it could catch fire. It had come to rest 300 meters from the beach, leaning nose down on the edge of a reef. Just beyond where the prow disappeared beneath the waves, the water took on a darker shade, a giveaway to a much deeper channel beyond. As he waded further, Five saw the wreck shift with a large backwash. The tide surged in, pushing against his thighs, and he hoped he had time to search the ship before the undertow came in and the Gemini was washed into the depths. Midway up the fuselage, he found an exit hatch torn from its housing, possibly a rescue effort from Haven before they realized just how much danger they were in themselves. The Gemini was tilted at nearly 35 degrees, confusing its insides, turning walls into floors and steps into vertical shafts, falling deep into the ship's interior. Weak emergency lighting allowed some slight luminescence, giving the stilted angles an odd, alien look, an impression amplified when the deck shifted with the rising tide. It was as if the ship was breathing its last. At corners, Five found blast doors, sealed in the emergency and impossible to open, or corridors flooded with black water. Each time he turned back was another lost minute, another chance for the Gemini to finally rock past it, the zenith it rested on, and tip into the ocean's depths. Finally, he found what he was looking for. The door to engineering was open and the section unflooded, and he wasted no time in setting to work. Nightjars had a black reputation. They were the ship to use if there was something an individual wanted moved that they'd rather was kept from the authorities. Rumors and wild tales circulated of cloaking technology sourced directly from the Star Realm, bypassing the Council of Seven. Had Five been given to find anything amusing, that would have been it. The truth was more prosaic, and much more direct. Why hide from a council ship when you could just appear behind them? Nightjars were nothing more than the smallest ships to house a McKinley drive, and that's why Five was on board. The drive was almost disappointingly ordinary to look at, little more than a lustrous black tube. Only a section showed in the engine room, the rest running the length of the ship, spearing it through the middle from bow to stern. The meter-thick section he stood before did not seem capable of being the sole reason for the Galactic Co-Prosperity Sphere's existence. This impression was lost on Five as he worked his fingers behind a panel on the drive's side and wrenched it free. His knife was out, slicing wires and cutting connections as his fingers rerouted command lines and power supplies. The floor rolled again with the tide, almost rocking the wire in Five's hand into a conduit which would short the circuit. He shook free a bead of sweat gathering on the tip of his nose before it could fall into the electronics. With a click, the controls lit up as the residual power from the emergency lighting dimmed with the sound of a turbine slowing. The leached power left almost no light, but Five was nearly finished. With a click, he slid the final cable home and was rewarded with a single flashing diode, silently counting down to ignition. The McKinley drive would now more accurately be called a bomb, and he had 5 hours to get out of the estimated blast zone, which should include Haven and its airspace. He checked his chronometer, sheathed his knife and turned to go, and stopped. Something was wrong. While his back had been turned, some basic detail had changed in the engine room, something different from when he had walked in. He attempted to isolate it. In the deepening dark, it was difficult to focus on anything. The flashing diode alternately created and banished shadows, throwing off any hope of distinguishing details. But Five did not think it was anything he could see. The background groaning of the Gemini, as it rocked with the tide, was still present, perhaps more insistent than before, but no, not that either. Rather, there was a smell, mixed amid the engine room air, below the grease and ozone, something sweet, something rotten. Five tensed. Not overtly, nothing to give away that his body was now on edge, thigh and shoulder muscles bunched, ready to unwind in a fraction of a second. Slowly enough that it would be difficult to tell in the light, Five's hand moved to his thigh. His thumb flicked open the catch on the holster. In a blur, the pistol was in his hand. All the while, his eyes scanned the room. The diode continued to flicker. On. Off. On. Off. Light. Dark. Light. Dark. The room was a monochrome of alternating dark and darker. He could see nothing out of place. His fingers flexed around the pistol grip, and he stepped forward. His foot unexpectedly met the deck as the Gemini lurched under another wave, sending a clanging ring to echo through the ship. Five froze, listening. Nothing, just the fading repeats of his misstep. He blinked, bringing his chronometer to his vision. His window of escape was getting smaller by the minute. He took another step towards the exit, and that was when he saw the locker by the door. He'd passed it on his way in. Some kind of heavy storage box, somewhere to keep EVA suits or other bulky equipment. In the crash landing, its door had swung open to lay flush against the wall. Or had it? Was it that way when he came in? There was a movement within the locker's shadows, a faint sound of something uncoiling with an organic wetness. Five reacted with inhuman speed, bringing his pistol up as the stage two inside launched itself into the room. He fired, much too early, but it was that or be far too late. The shot went wide, but the infected jinked away, altering its charge to Five's side instead of directly at him. Even so, Five was within the reach of its elongated arm as it passed. Its claws shot out for his chest. Five turned with the blow, taking some of the force with the spin, but he was not fast enough to completely avoid the impact. The Stage 2's claws raked across his chest plate, scoring deep grooves in the armor, and completed their swipe into and through his shoulder. Tearing through flesh and muscle, they ripped free in a spray of blood. White-hot agony flared for the briefest seconds before Five's metabolism shut down, feeling to the shoulder. The creature's momentum took it beyond him and further into the room, giving Five a moment to roll his shoulder. It moved, but if the tendon was damaged, he would not be able to rely on that arm for defense. Before it finished moving, the Stage 2 turned for another attack, or tried to. Its clawed feet scrambled on the hard deck without purchase, and its bulk sent it crashing into the wall. Five took the opportunity, aimed the pistol, and fired 3 times. This time his aim was good, but the infected was all movement. In its rush to right itself, not a single part of it remained still. The first 2 shots struck the carapace on its shoulder, deflecting to spark on the metal walls. But the third hit home. The back of its skull exploded, disappearing in a welter of bone and molted skin. Its head snapped back with the force, and even in the gloom, Five saw its pupils roll and disappear back into its eye sockets. Five lowered the pistol and allowed a measure of adrenaline to seep from his system. Immediately his shoulder began to throb. The combat had lasted 32 seconds, and the injury cost him speed in his escape from the blast zone. An escape which had suddenly escalated in importance, now he had to report the validation of plague presence in the area. He was mentally composing the report to command as the Stage 2's head whipped back down, its eyes and mouth opened, and it let forth a roar. It came at him, using the wall as a springboard to launch itself. Five went to raise the pistol, but the infected was too fast. On instinct, he moved side on, putting his damaged shoulder forward. Vague sensations of claws slicing through the already numbed arm were all he suffered, but he very much felt the warm splashes of fresh blood across his face and chest. He let the infected's momentum carry them both back, dropping as they went, and half rolled, half kicked the larger creature over him. The stage, too, flew higher than he expected. A lurch from below told him that it was not the throw, and the ship squealed as it tilted alarmingly. The infected compensated for the shifting floor better than him. It came up from its roll well, but still crashed into the locker it had hidden in. The locker shook loosely under the impact, its door swinging free. Five had a moment to wonder if it should be swinging like that, and realized the Gemini's angle had shifted steeply towards the vertical. He raised the pistol and fired. Behind the stage two, the locker shook under the impacts, until one shot struck where it was fixed to the wall. It shifted a fraction, and with a squeal of tearing metal, came free. The stage two did not turn. Its attention remained wholly on Five, even as a massive locker struck it from behind, carrying it down the tilting deck. Five had to duck and roll from its path, using his good hand to halt his slide down the steepened angle. The locker crashed into the wall below, shaking the deck and sending reverberations throughout the superstructure. The Gemini complained at its treatment loudly, groaning as its bulk shifted. Five felt the whole ship slip a fraction and heard water slosh somewhere off in the dark corridors. Time to go. He would have to half-climb out with one arm dangling messily at his side. He gritted his teeth, found traction with his boots, and was about to haul himself up when a sound from below stopped him. He turned. The heavy locker was moving, rocking in fits as something struggled beneath it. And then Five saw the stage two pinned beneath one corner into the wall. The locker had crushed it from the midsection down. Where the creature's body met the hard metal, translucent pink fluid seeped and pooled in slick patches. The stage two stared at him with malevolent eyes, hissing and spitting, reaching its arms for him impotently. Five heard water rising elsewhere in the hull and turned to climb out.
You did not terminate the second generation infected?
Not there.
Why not?
I had shot it through the frontal and perineal cranium, ejecting most of the brain tissue, and it still lived. I did not believe I had the weapons with me which could have killed it. Instead, I left knowing the explosion of the McKinley drive would annihilate it and any other drawn by its cries.
Very well. Do you have anything to add, Recon Unit?
He had been running for 4 hours and 43 minutes. His top speed was limited by the dead weight of his arm and the thick foliage along the forest floor. The chronometer countdown had reached single figures as he crested a ravine. He slid down to its bottom and pressed himself against the cool stone side as he waited to see if he had escaped the blast zone. His breathing and heart rate slowed quickly until it matched the beat of the descending seconds. 4, 3, 2, 1. The ground rumbled slightly, enough to shake loose topsoil. Then everything went still. Even the birds stayed quiet. At the edge of his hearing, there was a descending note, the dropped chord of some monstrous instrument. A gale broke over the ravine's lip with no warning. One moment all was still, the next the air tore with whipped tree bark. A pebble struck his cheek hard enough to draw blood, and off in the forest he heard the twisting snap of a tree breaking in two. And then, just as quickly, it was gone, leaving the air to rain with settling leaves. As the last note of wind died away, his comms lit up with chatter from his fleet, demanding confirmation of what just happened.
No, sir.
Recon Unit, your actions cost the parent corporation in excess of 50 trillion credits in destroyed property and forecast production quotas through loss of trained personnel in the Haven settlement. The shareholders are demanding answers and punishment. Is there anything you would say to that?
The Law of Armed Conflict Act, as it applies to the corporation collateral damage, states that all expenses and damages arising in the course of the defense of the greater community of the galactic co-prosperity sphere shall be borne by the affected corporations, with no recourse given by the defense services, which may or may not have caused them.
And what of the people? An estimated 10,000 civilians were registered in Haven when containment was called. With no bodies, is it assumed they were all killed during the initial explosion? What of them, Unit 5?
Five went to respond to the hails. It felt odd for him to be out of contact with anyone for as long as he had, but as he went to open the channels, he stopped. Above him, beyond where the ravine met the clear air, something drifted in a dying breeze. It flapped lightly, borne on the warm air, and began to fall towards him. It was thin and much too white for the forest's greens and browns. It drifted down on the air's whim, flitting this and that. It swirled, dropped, twisted, and finally came to rest by his boots, a rectangular paper soaked and gnawed on one corner, of two chalk-drawn stick figures holding hands.
By accepting aid from the rebel forces, all non-combatants were complicit, ma'am.
Very well. We shall return with our verdict in an hour. You shall wait here. Recon Unit 5235, upon review of your mission communications and the operational data file on your planetary positioning system, we find no evidence to contradict your testimony. That, in addition to your exemplary service record, leads us to find you not guilty of the charge of misconduct resulting in the loss of corporation property, and also not guilty of the secondary charge of loss of civilian life. Furthermore, your use of the McKinley Drive as a fusion propellant showed determination, quick thinking, and excellent improvisation skills. We are hereby authorized to thank you for your contribution. You may return to duty, Recon Unit.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, ma'am.